Rick Rule, founder and CEO of Rule Investment Media. Thanks for joining me. Welcome to The Confident Investor.
Pleasure, and congratulations on your new endeavor. Every success, which I'm sure you'll enjoy.
Thank you very much, Rick. I really appreciate the well wishes and of course the support, and just getting to speak with you. You and I always have some really interesting and profound conversations, and I'm sure this won't be any exception. Rick, you know, I've been speaking with many investors lately that have been in the metals or commodity space for many years, and now we're actually seeing some excitement and some capital come into these markets. And a lot of them are kind of pessimistic, or let's say worried about keeping what they have earned so far, as well as trying to capture more upside yet. So rightfully, they feel cautious about maybe a downturn or market crash because of all of the geopolitical and economic instability. So how do we go about thinking about this market from a, let's say, a psychological perspective as well as a strategic standpoint?
I think it depends on who you are, first of all, what your needs are, what your psychological tolerances are. This market, I think, has a lot further to go over time, but it may very well be extended in the near term. Investors who can't afford to be wrong or are psychologically or financially unprepared for volatility need to take some money off the table. Traditionally, precious metals bull markets follow a fairly predictable pattern. The metal moves first. Then the best of the miners move next. Then the best of the rest, and on down the market cap and quality trail. This market has progressed from the metal to the penny dreadfuls faster than any market in my memory. And I think it continues, but I think it gets choppy from here. What I've done personally, Tom, is in the last 3 weeks, I haven't sold any of my investment portfolio or any of my physical gold, but I have sold 25% of my juniors. I've done that because I've never seen the market react this quickly. I've done it too, because by selling 25% of my juniors, I can recap all the money I've invested in the sector for the last 5 years. I sold off 25% of my upside to eliminate 100% of my downside. Now, there are a lot of people who didn't get in the market as early as me. They don't have the ability to do this because they don't have that level of profit. There are other people who are younger, who either psychologically need bigger gains than I, or even financially need bigger gains than I. I've decided for myself that over the next 10 years, there's a lot of beta left in this system. And by trading a little bit of my alpha for some beta, I'm moving against the market, but I'm going to what I need. I remember very well, Tom, would have been maybe 1983, 1984, driving around Midland, Texas, an oil boom town that busted, and it busted in spades, you know? And I remember seeing a bumper sticker. The bumper sticker said this. It said, "God, give me one more bull market. I promise not to waste this one."
I've seen that one recently as well.
Yeah, I'm not going to waste this one. Now, I was there for the decade of the 70s, a bull market that made what we've seen so far look tame, truly tame. I remember in the middle of that bull market in 1975, the gold price fell by half. So your listeners need to ask themselves how they would feel. How much faith would they have in gold if the price fell by half? And you need to adjust your actions in terms of the psychological response that you might have, not just to volatility, but real cyclicality. By the way, when the gold price fell by half, and that shook out a lot of people, Tom, shook out a lot of people.
I bet.
You know, gold prices run from $35 to $200. That run, a sixfold move, man, you know, people were believing like Baptists, you know. That move from the 50% decline from 200 to 100 caused a lot of those Baptists to question their faith in God. And the people who got shaken out missed a move from 100 to 850 in 5.5 years. So people would do well to consider history in terms of their psychological and financial preparation for this bull market. I think this market's going to be one for the ages, but I think it's going to play out over time. And I think from time to time, it's going to test us. I think I just passed a test myself.
Well, of course, you have the benefit of having seen and learned from a market like that as well. Obviously, you have taken a lot of these lessons to heart and learned from, decades of experience in this sector. And I appreciate, you sharing those lessons with us. And obviously, when we're talking about just the gold price, that is, let's say, as you mentioned, that's maybe your investment side of your account.
Right.
But let's say the other more speculative side of your portfolio, do you have any specific rules or let's say frameworks in place on rebalancing or taking some of those profits? Or is it just taking that initial, possible downside, as you mentioned, off the table and then using the house money from there?
Yeah, I mean, it's more gut, I guess, Tom. What I do see is now that money's come down to the junior section, these companies are raising money like mad. When a company is raising money, what they're telling you is that they value the cash more than they value their shares. And who better to understand the value than the companies? Now, of course, they'll say, well, we just, in this circumstance, by taking on a little more capital, we can make the existing shares more valuable. You can make the existing shares more valuable by buying them in too. There are companies, Altius or EMX would be examples, that use their cash to buy in their shares. Those are companies that think their shares are undervalued. There are other companies, far more numerous, who are issuing shares for your cash. They're telling you something too. I've learned, Tom, that over time, you do what the market makes most convenient for you, not psychologically, but structurally. So, if you have a market like 2022, 2023, where despite the fact the gold price is moving, people are selling their gold shares, in other words, where there's an overwhelming preponderance of asks rather than bids, throw up a bid. Market's making it easy to be a buyer. In a market like this, where there's a preponderance of bids, throw up an ask. I try to do what the market asks me to do. I try to be very polite in that regard.
Yeah, I think, again, going back to another conversation I had the other day, it seems like when you think you're really smart and you think you're a genius for taking these positions, that is a time to finally think about and question that from the other side and think about the psychological parameter of being rewarded and still being able to, let's say, capitalize on that gain.
Tom, you make a wonderful point. What happens is that with financial goods, unlike physical goods, financial goods are Geffen goods, which is to say people value them more at higher prices than they did at lower prices. The reason for that, I think, is that the rising price levels validates the narrative. So people would rather buy high. And I try to make myself look beyond it. What happens is that when the narrative has been reinforced, you change your valuation metrics. In three cases, I bought junior stocks that ended up being mistakes. And in all three cases, the share price is materially higher. In other words, I got rewarded for making a mistake. Now, a situation where you get rewarded for making a mistake makes you extremely incautious. It makes you believe that you're in a good sector. And that's extremely dangerous. The other thing in my personal case is there were several positions where I owned in excess of 5% of the issued and outstanding. And they were fairly closely held, which means I probably own 10 or 15% of the float. In circumstances like that, the time that you take volume is when you can. When that window's open, if you have concentrated positions, You take them. Now, my great friend and mentor, Eric Sprott, says, nope, you got to have the courage to be really, really, really right. I don't have that much courage.
Well, again, I mean, you have the ability to and the time to not necessarily have to take that risk either. And I think
It's important to note, too, that I'm not taking money out of the sector per se. I'm taking some of the volatility and risk out of the sector. I'm selling a portfolio of juniors, good juniors, by the way. And I'm taking half that money and putting it back into the metal itself, and into a package of Franco, Wheaton, and Agnico Eagle. What I'm doing is I'm trying to capture beta in the market, while selling volatility. And selling, I'm selling alpha to buy beta. I'm going the opposite way of the way I think the market's going to go. It suits my personality. It suits where I am. I'm taking the other half of the money, by the way, and I'm putting in the oil and gas business, which you and I have talked about. That's a hated asset class. And for me, the easiest money in the sector is buying hate.
Well, I do want to get there, Rick, and I just want to reinforce your point of basically analyzing your winners just as thoroughly as you analyze your losers. You know, I read this book called The Art of Thinking Clearly, and in it he makes the point of making sure that you are analyzing your wins just as thoroughly as your losses, because if you got lucky, you're learning the wrong lessons. And you know, that's a perfect reinforcement to your point that you're talking about.
You know, in my own case, Tom, I had the extraordinary good fortune to come into the decade of the 1970s as a young man, interested in and relatively well versed in natural resources and precious metals. The consequence of that is that as a young man, I made amazing amounts of money in the decade of the 70s. I didn't analyze how I made the money, I didn't understand that markets worked. I allowed my success to value the narrative or cause me to value the narrative in a way that, despite the fact that I made a whole bunch of money in the decade of the 70s, I was functionally broke in 1982. In other words, the grandest bull market of my life ended up with me having participated in that market with a negative net worth. That's not going to happen again.
Rick, when we, you know, you're talking about the idea that markets work here. And I want to get your thoughts or your feeling towards if there is, let's say, or what the probability of a market crash at this point that results in metals and obviously miners being drawn down. Like, do you think that we could continue to see further upside in the general markets without a near-term crash because of how, let's say, how effective the powers that be have gotten at propping up the market and avoid really a meaningful and longer lasting crash since basically 2008?
I want to disclaim the expertise necessary to tell you that the equities markets are overpriced. I know how to value resource stocks, and I know how to value conventional financial services stocks. I don't know how to value tech stocks. So I can't tell you that the broad market is overpriced. I can tell you that the market by the Buffett ratio, as an example, the S&P 500 to GDP is in nosebleed territories. I don't know if that's a valuable metric or not. I'm not smart enough. To me, the market isn't a subject. It's a facility for buying and selling fractional ownership in businesses. You know, I'm an old-fashioned fundamental guy. Going back to the first part of the question, if we have a liquidity squeeze, a circumstance like 2008, if there's a real crisis in confidence, everything falls because the sales aren't made by Tom, you know, or Rick. They're made by margin clerks and they're dispassionate. They sell anything with a bid. I remember 2008, the gold quote hold held up for a day. There was a bid. It got hit. Gold got crushed. What happens is in the aftermath of that, the higher quality assets bubble to the top faster. Gold did very well in the 6 months after the 2008 event. But I remember the hewing and crying about people who thought that they were safe in gold, not understanding duration, not understanding why it didn't hold up in November, and getting crushed, getting shaken out. You don't need to do that either. If you go into a market crash liquid, like I went into 2008, market crashes are huge opportunities. They're like going out of business sales. If you know the value of an asset or have an idea of the value of the asset and it's attractive to you, if over the course of a week it falls by 50%, why, it should be twice as attractive to you. But that's not the way most folks think. It's not the way I thought in the decade of the 70s, but the scars I learned in the early part of the decade of the 80s made me think that way.
Rick, we've seen silver lease rates, for example, explode higher over the last couple of weeks, and supposedly some past 100%, some banks not even quoting lease rates to each other. Do you see this as more of a symptom of a breakdown of trust between banks? Like bullion banks
No,
in specific?
no. I see it as a function of materially higher silver prices in London than North America. You are seeing now in the futures markets where, by the way, frequently 200 times the amount of silver available for good delivery changes hands in a day. You are seeing traders who never take delivery take delivery and ship the metal to London. So there's not enough metal in the system. And the people who have metal in the system, who aren't taking advantage of the COMEX to LBMA arbitrage, are making up for it here. The silver squeeze that we are enjoying, if that's the right word right now, has two phenomena to it. One is the retail phenomenon, which is to say, silver is in really, really, really short supply in retail denominations. Ounce product, 100-gram product, that kind of stuff. I visited with Sprott on the phone yesterday. I don't work there anymore, but I still know him pretty well. And I said, "Are you guys able to get silver to support the silver trust?" They said, "Absolutely." The dealer banks have silver available for cash buyers for good delivery. It's easier for them to sell the silver into Toronto than it is to sell the silver into London. They don't have to charter a plane, as an example. And there's lots of silver out there that's not good delivery silver. That's why you see backwardation in the silver price. The futures prices a year from now are much lower than the prices that are there. That's the market telling you. There are location swaps in silver that are problematic right now. London is out of silver. But over the course of a year, there's a lot of silver that isn't good delivery that will become good delivery. It doesn't mean it'll become good delivery at this price, by the way. I would hate to be a dealer right now, Tom. The way most dealers conduct their business is that in effect they drop ship. For those guys, being able to access retail inventory, and more importantly, being able to finance and hedge that inventory is really hard. There are a few large solvent dealers, Eric Sprott is an example, Sprott Money, that have lots and lots and lots of inventory, and they have it in retail denominations. They're in wonderful, wonderful places. But the more conventional dealer, somebody who might do 60, 80, $100 million a year, where they rely on leasing to floor and then they hedge their order book. Those guys are in a world of hurt right now.
Well, that was another piece that I was wanted to ask you about is, we're seeing all of this, let's say, dislocation within the silver market. These dealers and even producers aren't necessarily able to hedge at this point because of this volatility. Like, how does that affect the rest of the market because of the, let's say, the dislocation or the the wrong location of the silver where it's being requested.
Well, right now it's inconvenient. Tom, you and I got to know each other during the last silver squeeze. Maybe several employers ago, but you were interviewing me in those days. And I recall telling you that there wasn't a shortage of silver per se. There was a problem in North America. You'll recall that the Sprott physical silver product was then, like now, a really good alternative because Sprott could get silver. We cleaned out Toronto, and then we cleaned out Ottawa, and then we cleaned out Chicago, and then we cleaned out New York and Boston. And we had to fly silver in jumbo jets from London and Zurich to here. Now the silver's going the other way. London and Zurich are cleaned out. And so now silver is going from North America to Europe. This circumstance will normalize over the course of a year. I need to tell, too, the younger people in the trade, the silver apes that you and I came to know and love 5 or 6 years ago, they harbor this wonderful, naive notion that they're going to be able to gang up and break the silver banks who are short, that they're going to cause such extraordinary shortages in the futures market that the future markets break. That's not the way futures markets work. The futures markets are owned by the banks and the member firms. And what they will do is what they did in the tin squeeze. When the market is functionally broken, they suspend the product, they set an arbitrary price, and they cash settle. If it sounds unfair, it's because it's unfair. And people need to understand that in terms of their expectation. I'm not saying you can't make money club and shorts. There was a point in time when I did a lot of that in the equities business. I actually set up short traps. It was a lot of fun, but it's a more detailed business than you think.
And probably quite a bit more stressful as well.
Wasn't stressful for me. I got to be pretty good at it. We had in the early part of the decade of the 90s an expectation that junior mining stocks would never go up, ever. And the consequence of that is that you could give these big short syndicates, whether they were in Vancouver or Jersey City, long periods of shallow upticks and let them get really, really, really short. And if you did that with a few friends who took out margin on their positions, not because they needed the money, but rather because they, like me, were ornery, and you made a borrow available, when you got the shorts long enough, your friends would pay off the margin, take back the collateral, and then you could begin the promotion cycle, understanding that the stock that was short guaranteed a buyer. The price at which that buy settled was done in a contest, you versus them in the market. And the people who were short didn't control the exchanges. That was a very, very different circumstance than the circumstance that we're in now. And the people that I was competing against were informal short syndicates, private parties, Jersey City based or Vancouver based. And it was actually pretty easy to whip them. Because they didn't think that we were ever going to come into a precious metals equities bull markets. And they never heard of the Doug Caseys or the Adrian Days of the world, the opinion makers who thought that busting shorts was fun.
Rick, to your point, as I've been thinking about the issues that London is having right now, and also the bullion banks that basically service and are a part of that system, I've been saying to people in conversations that I think the incentives are aligned for all of them to keep an orderly market and not necessarily be able to be broken, because if somebody needs silver, that the again the incentives are aligned such that they're going to help each other. Is that a reasonable way of looking at it?
Partially that, But the market isn't short silver. The silver's in the wrong place. The dealer banks, as recently as yesterday, the people who are allegedly stressed are selling physical silver to Sprott. People need to understand that. It's a very, very unpopular message. We'll get all kinds of hate in the comments
Absolutely.
around here. They'll say, well, what about 40% lease rates or 100% lease rates? That's because there's a 4% arbitrage
At this
between,
moment.
yeah, between New York and Chicago and London. So there's not a lot of silver around for lease. The people who are leasing it are people who are foregoing the arbitrage for higher lease rates. In other words, they're monetizing the arbitrage here against the dealers who need inventory to make the margins that they're making on retail sales.
So, Rick, I always hate asking. I always hate asking this type of question, but in this case, I think it would be interesting to get your thoughts. Do you think once this situation is resolved, let's say a year from now, we have a higher, equal, or lower silver price?
Higher. But I think I don't think that this circumstance will have any impact on the price. We will have a higher silver price because we'll have a higher gold price. We'll have a higher gold price because the US dollar is losing purchasing power. We have to go back to fundamentals and ignore the noise around the way things trade. Most speculators have a very short time frame, and they value drama highly. Most traders don't value math very highly, and they don't have a long-term time frame. The drama involved in the short squeeze, irrespective of the reality of silver inventories or the solvency of the dealer banks, is a lot more fun to think about than the US bond rate relative to US inflation, or the debt and deficits, or the Social Security deficit. The latter matters infinitely more than the drama.
Rick, do you ever consider, let's say, the gold to silver ratio as something that needs to revert to a historical mean? And, in the context of that question, do you think that because of the, let's say, the change in industrial usage of silver over time, that that has maybe changed the paradigm of this historical target, let's say, for that ratio?
I don't know why the gold silver ratio matters. I mean, I understand it's good for selling newsletters or earning commissions on stocks. But why the price action of commodities should be a function of their relative scarcity or abundance in the Earth's crust and not take into account production cost or utility is something that bothers me. It's obvious that silver has industrial applications. And if this gold-silver ratio mattered, one would expect that given silver's being consumed while gold isn't, that the gold-silver ratio should be narrowing. Silver goes to silver heaven. It gets used for photovoltaics, it gets used as a germicide, it gets used in water treatment. So if the gold-silver ratio actually mattered, why, when silver is used and gold doesn't? Is the gold-silver ratio widening as opposed to narrowing? As I say, I've struggled for 50 years to understand why the gold-silver ratio matters. And I've decided it matters like a factoid. In other words, it matters in the near term because people think it matters. But I can't understand any other reason why it would matter. In terms of future silver supply, the silver miners are almost irrelevant. You got to look at recycling, which is in itself a function of cost and price. And you have to look at byproduct production from copper, lead, zinc, and gold. All of those are untied to the gold-silver ratio.
And I think that goes back to this idea of really analyzing something, let's say soberly, if you will, because just because it's something that is often repeated doesn't mean that it's necessarily true, right?
You know, people pay attention to facts that they can obtain with no effort without really thinking whether those facts matter. People focus slavishly on share prices. And many of those people who focus slavishly on share prices have no opinion as to value. They think price and value is the same. They don't know how many shares are outstanding. Who cares if it sells for 50 cents, if you don't know, you know, what the whole business is worth? I would go so far as to say, Tom, if you don't have an informed opinion as to value, price is irrelevant. Money's made on the delta between price and value and price and expected value. That's where it's made. The same with the gold silver ratio. I don't think it's relevant, but it's easy to get. And the consequence of that is that people assign way too much value to something that I think is a factoid.
So inherent, let's say, in that answer of having a higher gold price a year from now because of this devaluation, it's really just a function of more dollars likely being printed by then, and that the denominator of the silver price being worth less, not necessarily silver just being worth more just because.
In my
It's playing
life,
some, just because it's playing some
and
kind
I
of
don't
catch
know
up.
why, precious metals bull markets are led by gold. The fear buyer comes first. The silver buyer is not a fear buyer. He or she's a greed buyer. When the precious metals narrative as a whole is validated by the price momentum in gold, and the generalist investor comes into the precious metals market, market leadership has in my life changed from gold to silver. I don't know why. I just know that. The price action in the silver market in the last 5 weeks would suggest that we're there. The silver price would appear to be going up at least twice as fast as the gold price. And we are seeing generalist mentions about gold and silver. Bank of America, Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, you know, all these people are starting to chatter. So it's completely consistent with past history. The generalist money has begun to percolate down into the precious metals market. And sure enough, leadership is going from gold to silver. I believe that we're going to have upside and downside volatility in precious metals markets. But I believe that the precious metals markets over time will at least go nominally higher, nominally meaning priced in US dollar terms higher, both gold and silver.
Rick, you mentioned the cost of production earlier, and obviously the other side of that is the cost of developing a lot of these projects as well. So what do you think the biggest challenges are on that side? Is this another, realistic example of something that you've told me countless times of the cure for low prices being solved by low prices? And are we in the middle of a, let's say, a normalization of new costs for this sector?
That's a great question, because the answer goes to the fact that existing producing assets with long lives are cheaper than people realize they are for three reasons. The inflation, which is central to my precious metals theme, is occurring in capital costs and construction, which is to say, what's $1 billion capital cost today? Likely is $1.2 billion a year from now, $1.6 billion 2 years from now, $2 billion 3 years from now. Permitting times are longer and longer and longer. Despite, as an example, Mr. Trump's protestations to the contrary, the Resolution Copper Mine in Arizona has been 27 years in permitting. And the third problem is that now that commodity rates are higher, the social rents are going to go up. The politicians didn't bother to steal resource rents for 20 or 30 years because they were too low. You know, they go where the money is. Now that resource prices are up, you will see increasing royalties, increasing carried interest, increasing taxes. And by the way, not just in Africa and South America. I'm old enough to remember when the natural gas price went up in the 90s, Alberta doubling the royalty overnight. All governments view their job as to steal. And the resource industry, now that it's solvent, is going to be viewed as an increasingly tempting target. The consequence of that is that deposits that at least nominally have their political accord in place, particularly financial stability agreements, companies that don't need to be permitted because they're permitted, and long-life production that doesn't need to be built because it's built, are going to be much more valuable than people think.
Directly to that point, Rick, we've seen the US government now take some 10% stakes in critical domestic companies. Do you see this as a positive development for the country and these companies, or could it be an initial sign of nationalization for some of these assets?
Hugely negative to allow a federal nexus in your business. Nice right now for some shareholders. I see as an example Trilogy, what did it triple? Trump not only, by the way, he did a good trade, maximum discount allowed by law with a warrant. And he acted on material non-public information, which is to say the biggest risk there was the road. And he said, I'm going to build the road. His own intention was material non-public information. I'm not going to press charges, by the way. But I haven't seen a government in my lifetime, with the possible exception of Norway, that's a good investor ever. Governments don't invest, they spend. In both Canada and the United States, there's an awful lot of intelligent investors. There's this wonderful thing called a market where those investors can use their expertise and express their preferences, and buy and sell ownership in fractional pieces of business on the exchange. I don't need and don't want the government to invest in natural resource stocks for me. Mr. Trump built his fortune, such as it is, in things like apartments and hotels. I would match my knowledge of critical minerals against Mr. Trump's any day. Any day. I think that mining companies who don't really care about the efficacy of stealing money from shareholders, particularly, or taxpayers, particularly, probably welcome the liquidity. They'll take a bid from wherever they can get it. But I think allowing a greater federal nexus in your business is a huge mistake. Now they have a seat at the table. Maybe they always had a seat at the table. They do, of course, have guns. But welcoming them seems odd to me. And on the other hand, from the taxpayer's point of view, have you ever seen a government investment ever once that worked? Not in my lifetime.
Maybe we should nominate you for Minister of Natural Resources then, Rick.
Were
Do you
I
think we could convince you to?
elected, I would demand an immediate recount.
I
I know my circle of competence, and it fortunately for me, and fortunately for the country, it doesn't extend to theft. So I wouldn't want to see myself in their shoes.
Rick, do you think it is instead of taking a position in these companies, do you think it's a reasonable step to build a sovereign wealth fund or some type of critical resource stockpile, if you will, to be used in, some type of emergency or, to combat the rare earth scarcity from China? Like, is there a reasonable case that can be made from that side?
No. No. If I mean, one thing the United States could do is get out of the way. Another thing that the United States could do is rattle its saber less aggressively against the Chinese. No, I mean, the government are very bad investors. They could get out of the way. When Mr. Trump talks about other countries taking advantage of us and answering that threat with tariffs. Tariffs are taxes. The Chinese don't pay the tax. The Canadians don't pay the tax. The U.S. consumer pays the tax. If Mr. Trump wanted to reindustrialize the United States, there's an easy way to do it. Reform the U.S. tax code. We have a consumption-centric tax code, a voter-centric tax code. Other countries, China as an example, have investor-centric tax codes. If you and I went to build a rare earth processing facility in the United States, we built a tilt-up concrete building. We would amortize for tax purposes the cost of that building over 33 years. In China, if we built that same building, we would expense it.
I think they could get out of the way from a regulation standpoint as well, right?
I mean, regulation is politicized, unfortunately. I believe that every resource development, including wind and solar, but oil and gas and mining too, should be bonded. There shouldn't be a promise to remediate. There should be a bond to remediate. But after you have that bond, all of the other stuff that goes into permitting is ridiculous. Look at the Resolution copper deposit. Average mine grade of copper worldwide is about 0.4. This thing is 1.5, three times the average grade worldwide. It's over a billion tons. So it's a big mother, right? And it's got a great location. It's between a couple of copper mines. There's a highway that goes across the lease, a railroad that goes across the lease, power, water, a nice town right there. And guess what? This town's full of copper miners, right? Doesn't get better than this. And it's been stuck in permitting for 27 years. Rather than subsidize the copper industry, if our government wanted to take greater steps to ensure American industrialization and self-sufficiency, pardon me, require resource products to be bonded so that real environmental concerns were addressed, engage in real regulatory reform, and change the U.S. tax code. Make the U.S. tax code as investor-friendly as communist countries are. Make the U.S. tax code, in fact, adopt the Swedish tax code verbatim if you want to. Take a Scandinavian socialist country and adopt their tax code with regards to investments. And you would kick off a capital investment boom in the United States, the likes of which we haven't seen since the 60s.
You mentioned this idea of the US's saber rattling at this point. Last week we saw Trump's remark to towards China, maybe imposing 100% tariffs on them, cause a ton of volatility. Do you think that there's any strategy or foresight behind remarks like that, or is this just, reactionary babble that has real world consequences?
I'm not a political scientist. I don't know. I know from a practical point of view that if you're going to win a fight, you fight them one at a time. You don't take on 100 folks. You pick fights where there's a probability that you can win. One of the things that Trump has done, Canada should be very grateful for. The Chinese have reacted by buying less U.S. oil and by buying more Canadian oil now that they have the ability to do that. In other words, Trump inadvertently is subsidizing Canada. Elbows up, right? I'm a fan of less government, smaller government. Trump campaigned on smaller government and gave us one of the largest budget deficits in history. He has decided, for whatever reason, to piss off the Canadians, piss off the Mexicans, piss off the Japanese, piss off the Chinese, piss off the Europeans, piss off the Russians. What's left? I guess our relations with Liechtenstein are still pretty good, but last time I looked, they weren't a major trading partner.
Do you think that there could ever be a meaningful enough amount of tariff revenue that will result in, let's say, taxation, less taxation for the average American?
Not a prayer. Not a prayer. Let's look at the arithmetic. This is really fun. This is where the rhetoric overwhelms reality. Our on-balance sheet liabilities in the U.S. exceed $37 trillion. So write that number down, right? 30 trillion net of the Fed's own balance sheet, which is to say net of counterfeiting. Our off-balance sheet liabilities exceed 120 trillion. This is the Congressional Budget Office saying this, by the way, not Rick Rule, okay? The on-balance sheet liabilities increase by $2 trillion a year. That's the little number, the 30 trillion. Most people don't know this, but the off-balance sheet liabilities, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, that grows by $2 trillion a year too. So the aggregate federal debt increases by $4 trillion a year. Okay? The aggregate income from all sources of the U.S. government before they spend a dime on anything, before Trump builds his ballroom, before they buy toilet paper for the Veterans Administration or whatever, the aggregate income of the U.S. federal government is $5 trillion a year. So our income before expenses is $5 trillion a year, and our deficit on balance sheet and off balance sheet grows $4 trillion a year. This is simple math. And these Washington morons, I was listening to, what's that guy's name? Famous investor, Bernie Sanders, that's his name, say that the way out of this dilemma, is to increase taxes on billionaires, right? And this is wonderful rhetoric, particularly for most of us that aren't billionaires, right? Like it's somebody else's problem, right? Well, let's do the arithmetic. The aggregate net worth of America's billionaires, according to the IRS, is $6.7 trillion. So never mind raising taxes. Let's steal all their money, right? Let's take them back to zero. You solve the problem for 19 months without dealing with principal. This idea that you are going to solve the deficit by changing the pocket that you pick. The taxpayer's pocket that you pick. In other words, you make it a tariff as opposed to an income tax or capital gains, ignores the quantum. The only way you deal with it is spending. That's the only way you deal with it, spending.
Rick, it seems like gold has regained some of its maybe signaling capacity to the market, and oil maybe has lost some of its signaling capacity because of the need for the US and really the rest of the world for stable and cheap energy. Do you think that this is a temporary condition that is worth considering how to take a position
I would argue with the premise.
in?
I think that gold is a monetary metal. And what it is signaling is that American savers are experiencing negative real interest rates. I think oil is economically sensitive. I think the weak oil price is signaling much weaker demand than people believe. And I think that's confirmed by the copper price. If you look in the copper industry, 7% of global copper supply is shut in. With the Grasberg collapse, with Cobre Panama being shut, with the Kakula flood, 7% of global copper supplies are shut in, and the copper price only increases by 5%. That tells me, I'm not an economist, by the way, but that tells me that in the current period, cash settled copper and gold is much weaker than people think it is. So I think oil's sending you an economic signal. And I think gold is sending you more of a political signal.
Because of, the need of, let's just leave it at the US at this point, because of their need for cheap energy and the political aims of that, you don't think that that is a somewhat a manipulated market at this point, Rick?
I might need a nasty weekend with three Victoria's Secrets models. If you need something that you can't have, it doesn't matter much that you have your perceived needs. We had a need in the decade of the 70s for cheap oil, and the oil price went from 3 to 30. Washington in the short term is more powerful than markets, but in the long term, markets work. Washington needs lower interest rates and they need a strong dollar. How do you do that? I mean, I get what you're saying, but I would suggest that the answer comes in your time frame. Can Washington manipulate down the short-term interest rate? Yes. If you look at the rate curve, it would appear that they're already losing control of the long end of the curve. Working as hard as they can on the short end of the curve, seeing the long-term rates go up, tell me that the markets are reinserting control over the long end of the curve. That'll happen in the oil and gas business too. Washington's preferences notwithstanding, the oil and gas industry worldwide, including the peristatal firms, are underinvesting in sustaining capital by $2 billion. I'm sorry, I got three zeros confused there. $2 billion a day. A day. That doesn't necessarily impact our ability to produce in 2025 or 2026, but it begins to make a difference in 2027, 2028. So if we find over the next couple of years, just looking forwards, not back, that the industry has deferred $2 trillion in sustaining capital investments, and as a consequence of of that, places in particular like Mexico and Venezuela and Russia experience even temporary, like 3 or 4 year declines in production. It doesn't matter what Washington would prefer. There is no oil. During the Arab oil embargo, Washington desperately needed lower oil prices. So did Japan. So did the European Union. So what? There was no oil.
When we think about, this idea that you brought up earlier, that China is now able to buy and buying a lot of Canadian oil, how do you look at, let's say, the entire situation with the possible separation of Alberta out of Canada? Does that affect your investment thesis on the picks and shovels, the actual oil producers, in a place that does produce so much of Canada's oil?
I don't think it happens, first of all. I think it would be great if it did, by the way. I'd like to see all of North America reorganize itself politically, but I don't think that'll happen. If you look, as an example, at the municipal government in Calgary, I would suggest that a rational response to Alberta's circumstance doesn't exist with Alberta voters. It doesn't impact it. A much bigger factor for me is Carney. Mr. Carney has said that his financial decisions will ma be made in the context of carbon. That's not helpful.
We should probably believe him.
Well, I don't know. On the other hand, unlike his predecessor, Carney can add and subtract. If he ever tables a budget, ever, I suspect that that budget will increase spending. And he is a banker. He will know that at some point in time, he needs to increase revenues. The industry in Canada that is the most globally competitive, other than perhaps rapeseed, is oil and gas. And I think that Carney pragmatically might have to temper some of his lunacy in favor of some form of solvency. I'm hoping that that's the case. He's making the right noise about building back better in Canada, building stronger, building bigger. Well, you have one industry that could do that in the near term. It's not the auto parts industry, by the way.
Again,
So I
this idea.
hope, I hope a bunch of things. I think a rising tide floats all ships. And I think the oil and gas industry is hated around the world. And as you know, Tom, there's nothing I love more than hate. A market that moves from hated to being tolerated is the easiest money on the planet. Oil's hated. I think the US oil industry is selling at a substantial discount to what it's worth. And I think the Canadian industry is selling at a discount to the US industry. That's as good as it gets. Now, I may be wrong about the political direction of Canada. If I am wrong, I probably lose 20% of the money I invested in the Canadian oil stocks. If I'm right, I got a 4 year, 5 year, four or five bagger. Not in penny dreadfuls, but in the biggest of the best.
Rick, can you share with us some of the stuff that you're working on or paying attention to at this point?
Well, as I say, I've sold a collection of my junior miners, a quarter of the position. And I've redeployed half of that money into higher quality gold, meaning physical gold, Agnico Eagle, Wheaton Precious, and Franco-Nevada. I'm sacrificing market alpha for market beta, which is appropriate for an old guy like me. You may know or you may not know that Battle Bank is in business now, which is a real focus for me. Rather than continue our effort to get chartered, we bought a bank. And we're now recapitalizing that bank and giving it the tools to go nationally. So we should be available as bankers, finally, after 5 years of trying, in early January. And that's probably my key focus right now, being able to deliver on the promises that we've made to 18,000 people who signed up to our wait list. And I'm greatly encouraged by the oil business. I'm probably early. The oil price tells me that globally the economy is softer than people think it is. But every time in my life when an industry has had pricing that doesn't incent sustaining capital investments, never mind new project investments. Every single time in my life, the outcome of that has been higher commodity prices. When you and I first talked about the uranium business, we talked about the fact that the global uranium price was less than the global cost of production. So nobody was investing. We were cannibalizing existing supplies, and the price has to go up. When something has to happen, it does. So that's what I'm doing.
And I think a point worth considering with Battle Bank, as I understand it, is that if people have capital tied up in physical metals, that they can actually use that capital to some extent, right?
Absolutely. We believe that gold and silver are good collateral. The big banks don't seem to think that. JP Morgan Chase will loan you money, but in $10 million increments. We're a bit more generous than that. If you have capital tied up in gold and silver, you don't have to borrow against it. You can just establish a credit line so that you have access to the money when you need it. We're really looking forward to that. I consider gold and silver to be good collateral. I have also come to know people who own gold and silver over time. They're good credits. They're good people. They're prudent. I'd like to lend to prudent, smart people. You can access the credit. Let's say that, there's a distressed real estate sale in your neighborhood. You want to buy a duplex or a triplex, but you got all your money tied up in gold and silver. This allows you to borrow against the gold and silver, buy the duplex or triplex, later on down the road, refinance out, pay down the loan. You still have your gold and silver, plus you have the duplex. That's what it's all about. Without paying the exorbitant capital gains tax that you'd pay now, if you were selling gold and silver that, you bought systematically over 20 or 25 years, like many of us have.
Right. Sounds like a very reasonable way of doing business, Rick.
We look forward to it.
Yeah. Rick, is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about or to consider before we wrap up here?
Two things. If you like what I have to say about natural resources and you want to personalize it, go to my website. RuleInvestmentMedia.com. List your natural resource stocks, and I personally will rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. Service is absolutely free, no obligation. RuleInvestmentMedia.com. If for any reason you're unhappy with your current bank, I think that means all of you. Check out Battle Bank at battlebank.com. We'll be open for retail business in the United States and Canada in early January.
I didn't realize it was Canada as well. That's good to hear.
Yes, sir.
Excellent. And of course, you're posting a little bit more on X as well at Real Rick Rule. Rick, thanks so much for your time today. I always very much appreciate the conversation.
Always a pleasure, Tom. And once again, congratulations on your new venture.
Thank you, sir.